Welcome to the Way Forward Regenerative Conversation Podcast number 7, Innovation Inspired by Nature, a conversation with Janine Binios. I'm Jim Burke, the producer. In this episode, we explore biomimicry, the bridge between biology and design. We talk with Janine about how using nature-inspired strategies can help mankind solve many of the most pressing problems of our time. Through her consultancy, Biomimicry 3.8, Janine works with large corporations and organizations to change their relationship with the built environment. By looking attentively at nature, she helps them design ecological performance standards for their infrastructure, which allow them to produce ecosystem services. These ecological gifts and flows are what you discover when studying healthy regenerative ecosystems. Our guest, Janine, is an American biologist, innovation consultant, and author of the groundbreaking book, Biomimicry, Innovation Inspired by Nature. She is co-founder of Biomimicry 3.8, a world-leading bio-inspired consultancy B Corporation. She's also co-founder of Biomimicry Institute, a bridge between biology and design, advancing the adoption of nature-inspired strategies to create more sustainable, efficient, resilient, and regenerative products and systems. Janine has introduced millions to biomimicry through her inspired TED Talks, keynote speeches, and documentaries. And now I would like to introduce the host of The Way Forward, Regenerative Conversations, Dr. John Izzo and Alain Gauthier.
Hi, I'm Dr. John Izzo, and on behalf of my co-host, Alain Gauthier, and our producer, Jim Burke, welcome to this episode of the Way Forward Regenerative Conversations podcast, where we ask the question, how must things change for humanity and planet to thrive now and in the future? Today, we want to explore our relationship to nature, and more particularly, what nature can teach us about solving the riddle of regeneration. You know, Alain, I'm so excited about this conversation today. I don't know about you, but for as long as I can remember, even as a child, I was concerned about the dysfunctional relationship we seemed to have with nature. Nature seemed so miraculous to me as a child, the way it continued to thrive even in the most challenging circumstances. And yet it occurred to me that not only did we take nature for granted, but often exploited it with little care about its impact in terms of what we were doing. And it seems to me when it comes to teachers about regenerative living, few could be better than nature itself, having for billions of years here on Earth continued to thrive and evolve through eons of cataclysm. So I'm excited about this conversation today, Alain.
I am too, John. And for me, biomimicry sends us back to what has been a tradition in many civilizations before ours, the indigenous, the Chinese, both East and West. Before the Western modern revolution, we had a different relationship to nature, including among the mystics in the Middle Ages in Europe. I'm all ears and wonderful to have this conversation with you.
Yeah, it seems especially since the Industrial Revolution, our relationship to nature changed, became more distant, less visceral, and we began to lose touch with that. Honestly, I can't think of anybody better to have join us for this conversation about nature and what we can learn from it than the person joining us today. Janine and I have shared the program a few times at Sustainable Brands, but Janine may not know the first time I heard her speak was around 2003, shortly after her book Biomimicry was published. I'd already given my keynote the day before and sat mesmerized as she talked about how scientists and innovators were looking to nature to discover ways to solve everyday problems as well as the biggest challenges of sustainability. She inspired me then, and she has inspired me since. So what an honor more than two decades later to be able to have this conversation. Janine, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, it's wonderful. No, I didn't know that, John. And that's great to know that you've been on this journey with me in some way. I've always enjoyed being with you and listening to your wisdom as well. So thanks. Thanks for having me, and thanks for inviting nature into this conversation.
Let's start with this idea that you wrote about now several decades ago, biomimicry, innovation inspired by nature, which was, again, initially published in the early 2000s. Please tell our audience, what is biomimicry?
Well, biomimicry is just, as that subtitle says, it's innovation inspired by nature. And as Alon said, it's not completely new. It's remedial for Western industrial culture to remember that life's been on Earth for 3.8 billion years. And in that time, it's learned what works and what lasts and what's appropriate here on Earth. And what biomimicry does is it says, well, when you're designing anything, be it, you know, a new kind of fuel cell or be it a team or an organization even, that it behooves us to look at this model, this long, time-tested, in-place model of how we might do whatever it is we're asking our design to do. So it literally now is an innovation practice since the book came out, where the people who make our world, and that's a large category, I think we are all designers, the first question they ask is, what would nature do here? And, you know, and it's a team sport. There's a biologist involved usually. And I've been doing this now for 25 years, working with designers, engineers, architects, inventors, managers, and having them ask, you know, what would nature do here? And we research whatever it is that they're trying to do, whether it's drag reduction or creating the perfect network, and say, how does nature do it? And then we describe those biological models.
And we were wondering what got you interested in making biomimicry your life's work, because I understand it is your life's work.
Yes, it has become my life's work. And yet it was my sixth book. So I'm a natural history writer. And I had written books about introducing people to ecosystem first field guides, where I would write about, instead of carrying all the field guides, you know, the mushroom field guide or the bird field guide, you would take a field guide that would introduce you to the habitats you were going to go to and who was going to be there and why they were there. You know, what were the organisms that were perfectly adapted to that place? So I did several of those, and I did animal behavior guides, and my whole life was trying to get people to fall in love with the natural world by understanding it better, right? By learning its language, so to speak. And my theory of change was that if people understood how miraculous life is, we would stay our hands. The habits we had picked up in the Industrial Revolution, we would think twice about them, because we would see these organisms as, we'd see a tree not as an ash tree right outside my window here, as not a, oh, that they make good baseball bats. You know, instead of seeing it that way, we would see it as, what a miraculous being that is transforming sunlight and soil minerals and water into life. We would begin to see those organisms differently. So as a natural history writer, that's really what got me into it. And back in 1990, when I started to collect for the book, there was not a name for this field. And literally, it was very difficult to find biomimetic papers in the scientific literature. Really difficult. I mean, it was a very faint signal. So I just started to collect and say, okay, every time I find a scientist who's studying leaves and also talking to solar cell manufacturers about how to make a solar cell, I'll clip it and save it. And it became, you know, eventually that became Xerox papers. Remember that? We were Xeroxing. It became four drawers of a filing cabinet. And I said, wow, this field does not have a name. And wow, it's time to name this field. One name.
Of course, we're old enough, at least Alon and I, to remember mimeograph. So Janine, we want to really dig in biomimicry and some examples in a moment, but you said something that really struck me. I'd like to get your response to it. You talked about out that window and seeing that ash tree as the miracle that it is, as opposed to simply, well, it could be a good baseball bat. And I play baseball, so nothing wrong with a good baseball bat. John Muir, of course, the founder of the Sierra Club, said that it would be impossible for people to preserve nature if they didn't experience it. And that's why he was so focused on getting people into the outdoors. I'm curious if you can say a bit, just as a scientist, if you will, why we should be so impressed with nature, and maybe how you think our kind of lack of experience in nature may contribute to our perhaps lack of willingness for some time to look at it as a teacher when it came to things like innovation. Mm-hmm. So kind of a broad question, but I'm curious your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, I have asked myself that a long time. Why did Western industrial culture move away? Because as Elaine said, you know, indigenous peoples who had lived in place, and the natural world is the embodiment of how to live well in place. And civilizations before us, when they did live in a place well for a long period of time, they really learned a lot. And I think they also looked at the natural world with respect. I think it was like, wow, these organisms can do things we would only dream of doing, you know, flying, for instance, right? I mean, you can imagine with what admiration we would look at these organisms, right? And we got away from that when we got on the end of a very long lever of our own technologies. We were like, well, we fly now. And so we did get very entranced with our own technologies to the point where we no longer had that respect. And we stopped being pattern seekers in the natural world. Biologists still do it. I mean, there's this whole group of people, ecologists and biologists, who are entranced and who are studying the natural world. But they are educated in a different stream, if you will, than the people who make our world, right? And so biomimicry is putting that back together into a fertile estuary, putting those two streams back together. But another part that you mentioned was that the separation, I think you're right, that when you lived well in a place and you knew your offspring were going to be living there. And this is what the natural world, that's why it has learned what it has learned over 3.8 billion years, because it's learned this simple thing that I think we used to learn when we lived in one place for a while. And that was, you have to take care of the place that's going to take care of your offspring. And the way you do that is not just, you don't just like farm that off to some restoration ecologists to do. You have to manufacture in a way that's going to take care of the place that's going to take care of your offspring. You have to eat and harvest and live and deal with your waste and do everything you're going to do in a way that cares for that place, because that place is going to take care of your offspring. And in the natural world, that offspring does not mean the next generation. It means generations, thousands, tens of thousands, millions of years from now, will your genetic material, that's the definition of success, will continuity of life happen? And that only happens if there's a place to take care of that offspring. And so what life learned to do is creates conditions conducive to life.
I was thinking, Janine, you know, as you know, I've written and talked a lot about purpose. And I remember at a sustainable brands conference, you kind of musing that the purpose of nature, if you look at how nature acts, not that it's necessarily sitting around thinking about purpose the way we are today, is this extension of the continuity of life. And it's an interesting maybe question for us as humans, right? Is that really how we act every day, as if our purpose as a species was the continuation of life? So it's a very profound idea that if nature had a purpose, it acts as if its purpose is to extend the continuity of life.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, you can say to yourself, what if the criteria for our designs, the design brief, if you will, or purpose for everything. So you could say to yourself, does my invention create conditions conducive to life? Well, we've never asked our inventions to do that. Does my iPhone create conditions conducive to life? At the end of its life, does it actually nourish soil? You know what I mean? Like we don't ask that of our designs or our company, does my company create conditions conducive to life? Is the decision I'm about to make, would that create conditions conducive to life? And sometimes we think about life as human life alone, right? But I'm talking capital L, and it's a design brief. I think it is the design brief. And then when you unpack that, how do you create conditions conducive to life? That's regeneration, right? That's what regeneration is that you continually make a place, you know, you make of, that's what life did, right? You know, it was 4.5 billion years ago. Life is 3.8 billion years old, but it came along, life came along, and it was a really harsh environment. Think about the earth, like this rock sea of like, just not very life friendly. And then life literally sweetened those waters and created the cocktail of gases that we need to survive, and built soil and filtered water and cleaned it. And that process is what regeneration, what we're tasked with now. We've got some places that life made of this place in Eden. That's a task before us now too, is to try to mimic that idea, right, of bringing this place, our planet, back to life.
So we've heard you say that nature can repair itself if we let it. So what are the most important things we need to do for that to happen? And so what are the key lessons nature gives us about regeneration as a civilization?
It's interesting because I come out of a natural resources management. I have a natural resources management degree in one of my degrees in forestry. Right. So I think a lot about this, like, what do we have to do? Because I was trained to think of us as managers of the forest. Can you imagine now, after my journey of amazing respect for these organisms, because I know the more you know, the more you go, wow, I'm not managing anything here. So what am I doing? How do we participate in bringing life back to Earth? It's not a hero journey. We're not going to be like the heroes who come in and do it. And I know this, you know, I live with my partner on 8 acres with 2 1-acre ponds in Montana. And when we bought the place, it had been completely overgrazed by horses, and it was covered by invasive weeds from Russia and spotted knapweed. And so I have experienced a regeneration journey. And I know that our role in it, as participants in it, is to create the conditions to help the helpers. There are organisms in the soil. Are there enough of them? Are they diverse enough? Can you create ways for rain to get pooled and to sink deeply into soil again? How do you participate in that? You set a banquet for the organisms that are actually going to do the healing, right? That's what you do. And you make sure that those conditions are optimal for them. You give them every advantage you can possibly give them, because they're the ones actually, right? You have to stop using pesticides. You have to stop overgrazing. There's a lot of things you have to stop doing. You know, if there's sediment pouring into your ponds and they're eutrophic and there's sediment coming in from up above, you have to create an area that organisms like cattails can start to slow that. I think humans are going to have to figure out how to move from this idea that we're managers, or even that we're going to run in and with a cape and save the day, to being on the healing team and standing back. And biomimicry is really good at this, in the sense that what you would do, and we've done it here on this property, is you go to a place that's healthy with humbleness, and you ask, how are you doing this? What are the patterns here? You know, and we become pattern seekers again of what health looks like. And then you notice it when it's coming back on your land, right? You notice it when you put your hands in the soil and there's earthworms suddenly where it used to be a dry and cakey dust bowl, because you've been to a healthy place. And so biomimicry is very much a part of regeneration, in that the healthiest places around us will be the teachers on a systems level, even what a healthy ecosystem looks like, how it functions.
It's a great idea to decide that we aren't going to manage nature coming back, that in fact, it's quite capable of that if we can create again the environment conducive to life. Obviously, Janine, one of the big issues around regeneration in nature for humans is agriculture. You know, the population of the world is approaching 8 billion now. Feeding all those people is a challenge in the best of times, and in the worst of times with climate change and droughts and loss of soil becoming an even bigger challenge. We know that you've written about the work of Wes Jackson and his work at the Land Institute. And at the same time, one of the other leaders of the regenerative agriculture has been Alan Savory. In his holistic perspective, how do you kind of contrast those approaches, and where do you think we need to go with agriculture to move to a regenerative place?
Well, you know, I think that in both of those examples, both Wes Jackson and Alan Savory looked to the natural world and how that was done in the natural world. And I think the closer agriculture becomes to the ecosystems of that place, the better off we'll be. For instance, Alan Savory was working in South Africa, and he was looking at how do you do grazing in South Africa without destroying the land, and realized that there were lots of grazers of grasslands in Africa. So watching them, he was able to see that they don't graze, they don't, because there's luck in many places, there's not fences around. They actually move around. Same way with the buffalo here. Mm-hmm. The buffalo in North America moved around, ate down the grass, and actually the grass evolved with these animals. So the grass where I live, for instance, I'm in a ponderosa parkland habitat, and there's grasslands, and we had grazers that would eat the grass, and then the grass actually would respond by growing, by shedding some of its roots into the ground, which would sink carbon into the ground and sequester carbon, and then have another flush of growth, which would grow more roots. So that's where you get carbon sequestration in soils. But if you put, for instance, on my land, horses long enough, and without moving them off to allow the regeneration, to allow the flush back, that's when destruction happens, right? So basically, Alan was saying, follow like the buffalo do and move the animals. If you have cattle on your land, move them around to small paddocks, right? Rotational grazing, it's called. And then with Wes, he was saying, our agricultural lands look so different than, say, a prairie, which in North America is where we have a lot of it used to be prairie. And so when you go over to a fragment of remaining prairie, what do you see? It's mostly perennial plants with long root systems, diversity, crazy amounts of species, 200 species in the same field, right? And then you go to a wheat field, and it's one species of annual plants that you dig up. You dig up the soil every year and, you know, plant your seeds again, and you pesticide everything else away. You know, how different is that, right? And said, well, what if we could go back to, what if we could perennialize crops so that they're overwintering? And he's had success now with wheat. You can drink, you know, Patagonia Provisions does a great long root ale that's made with kernels of wheat that is perennial wheat that stays on the land over the winter, right? And then the next thing we have to figure out is how do we put crops together in mixtures so that we have the diversity that is similar to what happens in the prairie? Because that diversity, you know, say you're a pest and you specialize in wheat. So you get to a wheat field and you're like, whoa, all I can eat restaurant. But if you have a diversity, you know, you get to a wheat stalk and then the next thing you fly to, you can't eat. Right. So there's this natural, or if you put in the diversity, you put nitrogen fixers so you don't have to apply nitrogen. So now you've dropped pesticides and nitrogen, right, from your inputs, from your agricultural inputs. And most of the food around the world is grown by smallholders, by people on 5 acres or less, right? So the other thing there is to make sure we understand that they're the folks who are right now, like, let's not them have them move to our supposed agricultural revolution of monocultures, because many of them are still growing trees along with their crops, right? They're growing shade-grown coffee, say, right? That idea of it looks more like the tropical forest next door. Let's not have them run down the efficiency gap, you know, thing, because we already know that's a box canyon, that's a dead end. So whatever example I see, whether it's silvopasture, agroecology, these are all examples of putting mixtures together, trees with crops, say, and trying to mimic the kinds of things that grow there, the kind of structure you have, right? The three-story forest. So have a three-story agriculture, right? They're all, or if you're in a prairie, do that diversity and do perennialism. Those are all mimicry of local places.
So shifting from agriculture to industry and cities, we understand that you and your biomimicry 3.8 has been doing quite a bit of consulting with both industries, companies, and cities and villages also. So what are some examples of what biomimicry has offered them in terms of regeneration?
It's actually the work that I'm really, really excited about, work and process design work to reimagine chemistries that are less toxic and products that are more energy efficient. And then we said to ourselves, how would a city be biomimetic? And a city is more like an ecosystem. So you're going to mimic an ecosystem. And we started to work with architectural companies, engineering companies. And that's a really big impact. If we look at the people who are building our world, right? Building is our built world. That's our largest human artifact, right? And it's got a huge impact environmentally, as we know, the use of materials and the energy use. And it's our cities, it's our buildings, it's our human settlements. And so we said, okay, what is a biomimetic development? What would that look like? We know that if you look at a healthy ecosystem, what you know about a high-performing, healthy, functional forest or coral reef or prairie is that they actually produce beneficial flows of goods and services, we call them, but they're beneficial flows beyond their borders. So what happens is these ecosystems, and you can measure this, and we do. So if we're going to do a development somewhere, we go to the healthiest place we can find. And what we measure is how much water is being cleaned, because that's a beneficial flow. It sends the water downstream cleaner than when it came in. Air coming into a forest gets cleaned, gets purified, and is sent downwind cleaner than when it came in. So that output, that exhale, if you will, of goodness, right? How much wildlife does it support? Wildlife that can migrate somewhere else, right? How much soil is being built and nutrients being recycled? You can actually measure all of these things. How much cooling of the air happens? These are called ecosystem services by the UN. There are these ecological gifts, and we measure about 21 of them. So we go into, and therefore we have measurements. We know that per acre, this is how much carbon is being stored on this forest, right next door, not 200 years ago, but today. This is how much water is being filtered. This is how much water is being stored, right? This is how much wildlife is being supported. And then we come over to the building site or to the existing building, and we say, per acre, this is what you now have to meet. We call them ecological performance standards. Now, talk about asking your design to do something that you haven't asked your design to do before. So, you know, at first, you know, our clients were like, well, why would we create benefits for the downstream or downwind or for our neighbors? Because life is generous. That's the generosity in life. And it's at the root, right, of this word regeneration. It's regenerous, really. And that's part of how the biosphere regenerates itself, is that when a healthy forest is able to have the abundance to do this, right? And we began talking to our clients, and our clients are like Ford Motor Company, building giant, giant EV factory down in, you know, Tennessee, and the Lightning Ford factory, 4,200 acres. We're talking, some of these places are pretty big. And then you talked about Microsoft, which is a client who's doing this with us as well. They're building 30 to 50 data centers, giant buildings with giant parking lots a year for the foreseeable future. So then you say to yourself, okay, let's template these things. And if we can say, and these companies are doing it, Kohler and the packaging people for P&G and Logoplast, and we've got several companies that are in a learning cohort. And what they're doing is, when they build, they're trying to figure out how many beneficial ecosystem services their buildings and the site can produce. How close can they get to that ecological ideal? We call it Project Positive. It's a learning cohort because design for ecosystem services is a whole new category of infrastructure design. We're not just asking the landscaping to do it. We're saying, can your building store carbon? Can your building cool the air? Can your building filter, you know, can you store carbon in your building with CO2 sequestering cement, coral reef inspired? Can you do it with mass timbers? Can you have a green roof and a blue roof that stores carbon, that supports pollinators? You know, your building and the streets, can they be permeable pavements so they store water? Can they be cooling of the air? You know, of course you're going to put trees out. You're definitely going to have a lusher place, but it's going to be because life does help us. You're going to have green walls and phytoremediation walls. But to get to those metrics, they're really aspirational. So the building, the infrastructure has to do it too. And it really changes design, changes where we put the buildings, what form the buildings are in. You know, we did one building, our HOK is our partner, our architectural partner, and Jacobs is our engineering partner. And HOK did a building in DC, the Coast Guard building. They looked at we bring the metrics, the biological metrics, and then we also bring the organism examples. So the organism example in that part of the world for purifying water was the beaver. Because in a watershed, they create all of these cascading. It used to be a pond. It turns back into a marsh. And those are, in a watershed, they help purify water and store water and slow it and sink it. So they were going to build a big monolithic building. And they wound up building a building with all kinds of different levels of green roof. And they were on a sloping site. And water came into the site here. And it went down just like a beaver. All the green roofs were connected. Mm. And it wound up in a lake. And by the time it was in the lake, the water was very nicely purified because each roof had a different kind of plant configuration. So this is not what we used to have our buildings do.
Yeah. It's so exciting, the idea that the human infrastructure can become the same kind of generative force as the natural structure. And, you know, as I was listening to you, Janine, and so excited about all the work that you're doing and that your clients are doing, is people might say, well, why do this? You know, and what occurred to me as I listened to you is sort of, it'd be a mistake to say, oh, therefore nature is generous. I think what would be more true, and I wonder if you agree with me, is that if you're regenerative, you wind up surviving, right? Because if you're a giver and you create this atmosphere, again, conducive to life, you're more likely to survive and thrive. So what's in it for us is, if we become generative, well, yes, we're more likely to thrive and survive. And it happens to be the right moral thing to do. But anybody who's wondering, why do this? Well, yes, nature didn't do this out of the goodness of its heart. It's because it figured out over several billion years, that's how you keep the party going. Am I right?
Hey, you're so right, John. That's exactly it. I mean, when you think about natural selection, it's selection. People always think, oh, natural selection extincts certain things. Think of it the other way. It chooses certain things. It selects them out of variation. And what it selects are the organisms that have figured out how to give back. Because regeneration really begins with making sure you're reinvesting in the place. So leaves fall off a tree and they don't get like, except with us, they don't get like bagged up and taken somewhere else. They reinvest in the soil. Now that soil is going to help that tree for sure, but it's also going to help all the other organisms in the, you know, in the understory. And now we know these trees are connected by mycorrhizal fungi in the wood wide web, and they're transferring these nutrients to each other. And yeah, it's exactly right. When they're creating their world, but not just their world, right? I mean, their world is not, they don't think of it as having boundaries, property boundaries. Their world is the biosphere. So if you're generous, like you send this exhale out, that's reinvesting in your biosphere.
Yeah, beautiful. Janine, I want to, you mentioned about the ranch in Montana, and I know you grew up in New Jersey. I grew up in Staten Island, New York, so not far from you. I know you grew up in New Jersey, but now you live in Montana. And we don't have time for maybe a long version of this, but I know, as you said, you had a ranch that had really deteriorated. And your neighbors are not necessarily New York progressives, so to speak. Not that that's a good or a bad thing, but, you know, people who've lived on the land for a long time. I'm curious how your neighbors reacted to some of what you were doing on the ranch, and maybe what you learned about finding common ground with people who you might not always agree with. So I know it's a big question and you could spend hours on it, but talk a little bit about that experience.
Yeah, it was amazing because I do live in a place where, while Montana used to be Democratic farm labor like Minnesota, it has moved right politically very, very far to the right. And so that conflict could be here. But because we live in a large landscape together, and what brought everybody here was not a job, but a love of this landscape, that gets prioritized here. So what I was, you know, when my partner and I came in, we had been, you know, we lived in St. Paul. We kept our houses in St. Paul. We were like, oh my gosh, how's this going to go? And what we found out that was that the people here were far more tolerant than many of the people we knew in St. Paul. Let me tell you. There's definitely a live and let live, but there were things that they had limits about. And that was, they said to us, we don't care who you love and good for you gals, but we care about how you treat your land, how you treat your water, and how you treat your animals. And if we see that that's not working out, we really are going to take issue with what's going on. And I thought that's priority. You know, that's prioritization. And the people who have lived here for five generations, the white people who have lived here before the Salish, after the Salish Kootenai, have enhanced this place. It's a ranching community and it's in good shape. Their lands are in good shape. I happen to have a piece of land that somebody had a little, you know, it's a ranchette, right? So somebody didn't know what was happening. So that having too many horses on was something that they were really glad to see that person move on and us to move in. And so they were rooting for us. And so we just learned what we learned about regeneration here is you don't get rid of knapweed. You make the conditions better for grasses and you don't know which ones to put in. So you need to sow a diversity of them. So we would broadcast seed. It took us 12 years to regenerate this place. And we, you know, as I said, like to help regenerate it, we broadcast seeded in every one of those 12 years, a different species, a different mixture of grass and forb and species. Cause we knew as ecologists, we're both ecologists. We knew that diversity leads to the ability for a system to regenerate itself, right? That's one of the biggies, you know, so make sure that you've got, and it's really true. There's two kinds of diversity, functional and response diversity. Functional is make sure you have a gin fixer, you've got a lung, you know, you've got a legume, you've got a composite, you have different kinds of functions in the ecosystem, in the, you know, in that grassland. But then response diversity is make sure you don't have just one nitrogen fixer, because you might have a dry spring. You need response diversity. You have 12 different kinds of nitrogen fixers, so that in a dry spring, different ones come up. Every year we walk out into the pasture and go, wow, it's a completely different community that's come up this year. Yeah. So that really, really taught us. And the ranchers around us, there was one rancher in particular, Hans McPherson, and he was constantly coming by and going, oh my God, you guys, what are you doing? Because we had goats. We had 30 goats that would chew down the knapweed. We'd 30 goats for about 31 days. And then we would broadcast seed. And they were just like, what are you guys doing? That's, you know, and they would kid us and say, hey, do you want me to have my chemical guy call you? He doesn't have a chemical guy. But when it turned around, they're the ones who, what happened actually is that one year we looked out and most of the knapweed was gone. And this beautiful green stuff was coming up. And then in 2 weeks, it turned brown. And we realized that it was another weed called cheatgrass, which is almost worse. And he came by as I was realizing that was happening. And he said, don't worry, it's the turnaround crop. You'll be fine next year. Wait till next year. And next year it came up like it was way over our heads. It was amazing. And so they were rooting for us, is what I'm saying. Like, we may have different political beliefs right now. I think that will change. But they had a lot of respect for us. And they will be there for us. We live in a place where there are floods and there's outages of electricity and it's really cold sometimes in the winter. And they have always been there for us. I've learned a lot. I'm glad I live here in a place that, you know, I used to live in places that were everybody around me was exactly like me.
Wonderful to hear about these examples, both agriculture, industry, cities. And we are wondering what shift in worldview, what inner changes are needed for more people to actually treat nature as a model, as a measure, as a mentor, as you say, to learn from nature instead of learning about nature.
Yeah, that's a huge difference. That's a big difference. Learning from instead of learning about is, you know, it requires a different kind of biology even, because we've been, science has for a long time been learning about. Learning from is very, very different, because your worldview has to shift from one of better than, I am better than, to one of, I am a young species. Teach me. Humility. Yeah, humility. I mean, if hubris got us here, humility will get us to the point where we can actually listen and go out and look for those patterns and listen to what we're being taught. The answers are there. Respect is such a strong emotion and such a strong stance. That's the one, that's another worldview shift, is it's not just, I admire you, but respect. Like, if you have a mentor in your life, you know what that feels like. And you know the kind of special protectiveness that you feel towards that mentor, gratitude that you feel towards that mentor. Imagine if our worldview shifted to one of respect. In the environmental community, often we have a emotion called pity. We pity the polar bear, you know? That's not a very strong emotion. You know, respect is, I don't know, biomimicry is very much about us getting Western industrial culture, once again, getting in right relation with the rest of the natural world. realizing we are nature is a big part of going, okay, we are nature, but we're young. 200,000 years versus 3.8 billion.
It's such a beautiful image, Janine, that what you said, we're a very young species. Teach us this idea of really respecting what nature has to teach us. I think of that you mentioned humility, which comes from, of course, humus, from ground. That's actually where the word humility comes from, coming to ground, right? To realize, wow, you know, this rest of nature has been doing this for, you know, several billion years, and we're pretty new at it. And arguably, we're kind of pretty successful for a while, but maybe that's deteriorating a little bit. So maybe it's time for a little coming to ground and, as you said, respect in the sense of what can it teach us and how can we be in harmony with it? One final question, Janine. What gives you hope? You've been at this for quite a while now. There's a lot of despairing voices out there about where we're headed, especially in terms of environment. Last question to you. What gives you hope about a way forward for humanity and planet?
You know, I have a educated optimism. I really do. And I do believe optimism is a choice too. You can choose that. And so I kind of look for those hopeful sparks. And I live in a world of solution seekers just by dint of who we work with and play with and educate. It's people looking for solutions. And there's so many brilliant humans who have already taken that worldview shift and said, oh my gosh, we have a lot to solve. And look at this beautiful, you know, these organisms willing to gift us with their advice, right? That shift, people in biomimicry tend to be optimistic because there are so many models in the rest of the natural world that we haven't looked to yet. Right. And so the field is growing, you know, just ski slope of, you know, new papers and new people, you know, teaching classes in it. And it's grown. You know, what gives me hope is watching the trajectory of something like as big of an inflection point as I think biomimicry is in our culture, to see it come on so quickly. 25 years is not that. I remember in 1990 when there was hardly anybody doing this at all. And now, you know, it's, you go on Google and there's, you know, tens of millions of pages and so many books on bio-inspired, biomimetic, biological engineering, so many biologically inspired engineering, so many, you know, people are now doing this. That gives me great hope, because what I do trust is that the models that they're looking at they've evolved in place in their context, and they're the answer to the question the land is asking. So those solutions have within them, they teach us something about how to live here gracefully. You know, because over long periods of time, they could only live here if they were a contributing, welcome part of the larger biosphere, right? So that's incredibly hopeful. We're not guessing when we go there. We're not guessing as to like, well, how will this work out?
That's great. And certainly you're part of what gives me hope and your work and has for some time now. And I love what you said, that while it may seem the problems are going exponential, the desire, yearning, and seeking for solutions, especially from nature, is perhaps going even more exponential. And the other thing is, I would remind the listeners, you said that one of the things that nature learned was, you know, I had to stay in this space. Well, a good reminder that since all of us aren't going to Mars anytime soon, all of us are also going to have to stay in this one beautiful space called Earth. And you've certainly given us a great journey today to think about that. So thank you, Janine. I'll give Alon a moment to say a closing word. I want to thank you and also just encourage people to read your books, follow your work, Google her, go to her institute. And if you're a company and you need some advice, they're great people to go to. So Alon, over to you, and then I'll say a closing word.
Yes, thank you so much for all the elements you've brought in the conversation. And going back to where I, so there is for us a possibility to reclaim the indigenous wisdom that we had. And you certainly have contributed a lot to that. Thank you.
Thank you, guys. You know what I would love to ask you both? Because I think it's an important point, this humility. How do we become a more humble species in your estimation? What's the path?
Alon, go ahead.
Well, I think humility for me goes with listening. It's a more feminine quality than a masculine quality. We have a very masculine culture, which is always striving for, wanting to, instead of sitting with and observing. And I think the two are connected, the willingness to listen, to observe, to be with.
And I guess for me, building on that, I think humility ultimately comes from curiosity. And I've often said, because I work with organizations and leaders primarily over the last 40 years, is I say the most destructive thing is an organization or a leader who believes that they have it licked, they figured it out. The belief that the system we've created is the best of all possible systems, right? And so whether it's capitalism, socialism, you know, our economic system, I think just being curious is what makes you humble. I'm curious what else is possible. I'm curious how anyone else has done this. I'm curious what I could learn from you, another society, another village, another nature, another rancher. So to me, it begins, humility begins with curiosity and the idea that whatever I'm doing right now, it's probably not the best of all possible worlds. There probably is another way to do it. And curiosity, I think, breeds humility. And it's a really important question, because I think humility is what we need most of all right now, because believing we have the answer has kind of gotten us into the position we're in. So just being curious to me is so important.
Yeah. That's amazing. That is really amazing. That's, you know, that there's something called adaptive capacity in ecosystems, which allow them to regenerate. Even if conditions change dramatically, they're able to shift and adapt, right? And that idea that we don't live in a static world that, oh, we fix it once and it's fixed. And we kind of cultivate that listening that Alon was talking about, that we're always listening because we know the world is changing. And that we just keep, that curiosity is the best adaptive trait you could have, right?
Yeah, you know, Thomas Jefferson said that if for a democracy to survive, there would have to be a revolution about every 20 to 25 years. And of course, he didn't mean a physical, violent revolution, but that one would have to continue to be curious about how the experiment must evolve.
What, when you hear some of the characteristics of nature's approach to regeneration, right? Diversity, the importance of diversity, right? The importance of reinvesting in every living organism that's there. The importance of not just creating something for your own forest, but passing it on to biosphere wide. What does it make you think of in, like, as lessons for our economic system?
Well, when I think about that, I've been quite involved in issues of climate and international cooperation for a long time now. And take a simple example of, well, why should the developed world be paying for ecosystem repair or adaptation in the developing world around things like climate change? Hmm. Well, because by doing that, we're creating the ecosystem that's conducive to life for this one place that we share. Going back to what I said earlier about the idea that nature isn't generous because it's altruistic, though it may be altruistic, right? But it's generous because generous is generative, because generous produces life. And so I think that that's one thing we can learn from nature, is that by exporting goodness and generative conditions, whether it's from the developed world to the developing world, or from the rich to the poor. You know, I think of a friend of mine who lived in Mexico for years, you know, upper middle class, he was in management. And after the fourth time he was held up at gunpoint in a grocery store, he moved to Canada with his family. And one of the things that George said to me is, it didn't matter how much money you had in a society where people had almost nothing. Sooner or later, didn't matter how many guards or fences there were around your community, it was going to impact you. And I think what nature teaches us is that, you know, if you're not generous, sooner or later, it comes back to you. And I feel like that's a really important lesson for us to learn. And it goes beyond the natural world. It goes to our artificial economic systems that we've set up and the way in which they're not generative in the long term. So I think, to me, that's what comes up for me, is starting to think about those kinds of issues.
Beautiful.
One of the aspects that comes to my mind is that the fact that benefit corporations, for instance, are experimenting with a number of criteria by which they use to measure how effective. So instead of the one short-term profit goal, you know, have 10 criteria by which you evaluate your own usefulness.
Totally agree. We're a B Corp, and it's interesting to watch those criteria change and make us better. They don't stay the same. You know, we're asking more and more of our companies too.
So thank you so much, Janine. Thank you, Alon, for a beautiful conversation. Most of all, I want to thank you, listeners, for tuning into our podcast today. Please, if you liked what you heard today, share it and tell others. If you liked what you heard today, but you think there are ways it could be better, or guests we should have come join us, please write us. We'd love to hear from you. In the meantime, thank you for listening to the Regenerative Conversations podcast. And I'd like to thank Janine again for being with us. Have a good day.
I want to thank you for taking the time to listen to our podcast, The Way Forward Regenerative Conversations. You have many choices, and we appreciate your interest and support. You can reach us at our email address, thewayforwardrc@gmail.com. I would also like to thank our sponsors, Elders Action Network and Blueprint NGO. Elders Action Network is building a movement of elders to address the environmental, governance, and social issues of our time. Their website is eldersaction.org. Blueprint is catalyzing a global conversation about the state and impact of men in the world. Together, they are mobilizing men to be a force for good. Their website is blueprint.ngo. Until next time, I'm Jim Burke, and this was the Way Forward Regenerative Conversation podcast, which you can listen to on Podbean and Apple Podcasts.